to the L. Barrio, you know we got flow. East Harlem, home of the Bogner Show. Listen, podcast dishing, easy going. On the show where the hot air's always blowing. Downloading, never miss an episode. Keep it real, always serve it Alamo. New York, New York, if you can make it here, you know the rest, you can make it anywhere.
Show. This is episode 90 of the Brad Bogner Show. Our guest today is Tim Wendel, author of many books, including most recently Summer of 68, the season that changed baseball and America forever. Thanks a lot for being on the show today, Tim. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Brad. Great to be with you.
And I thought what was so inspiring about this book, aside from the fact that it was so fascinating about this very pivotal, tumultuous year in American history, was you said early on in the book you actually got this idea while watching cable news. And that seemed very inspiring that something great could come out of something so, you know, kind of angry and hateful almost.
Yeah, I was channel surfing one night, which I'm prone to do. It drives my family crazy. And I was going back and forth. I live outside of Washington, D.C., and you know, looking at, probably Fox News, MSNBC, the local outlets, and it occurred to me yet again, we don't really listen to each other anymore in this country. And what the nice thing about history, as you well know, Brad, is you can kind of go back to times when things were potentially worse, and somehow we got through them as a country. And certainly the summer of 68 was worse, and I think we got through it in a large part because of baseball in general, or sports in general, and baseball specifically.
And it was just incredible how many big sports moments there were, and it was pretty insane. Right off the bat, to start the baseball season, Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated, and then, you know, baseball, for the most part, decides to postpone most of the opening games. 8 weeks later, Robert F. Kennedy is assassinated as well, and there's sort of this whole controversy about almost no games were canceled. Some players kind of took the day off, but it was very interesting to see such an opposite reaction almost from both those major political figures being assassinated so close together.
Yeah, very much so. I think baseball, in essence, dropped the ball. I think the lack of leadership from on high, certainly from the commissioner's office after Bobby Kennedy's assassination, was dreadful, for lack of a better term. I mean, they pretty much left it up to the ball clubs outside of New York, or those playing in New York or Washington, and they pretty much said, okay, you guys vote. You guys decide if you want to play or not. And you talk about putting a divisive issue into a clubhouse. I mean, a great many teams really had to have several votes. They ended up in arguments, etc., and it tore some teams apart. Ironically, a team that was kind of brought together by this was the New York Mets. The Mets were out in the summer of 68, supposed to be playing that day after Kennedy's assassination, which is ironic because, you know, Kennedy has been assassinated just down the coast in Los Angeles at the Ambassador Hotel, and they were due to play in San Francisco. And it was that day in San Francisco, probably a crowd of probably 40,000 or so. And Bill Hodges, the manager, went room to room in the hotel where the Mets were staying and told the players, we will not play today. If we get in any trouble, if we're criticized, I will take the heat. And they didn't take the field. They didn't even show up at the ballpark. And you talk to some of those old Mets now, and they say, hey, you know, we really started to come together as a team, you know, because of that incident. And they felt, at least several did, that it helped them then become the amazing Mets and, of course, win the World Series the following year in 69.
Another team that seemed to be not necessarily brought together, but very interesting melting pot was the St. Louis Cardinals had a fair amount of whites, blacks, and Latinos playing together, especially for the 68 season. And considering the fact that St. Louis wasn't necessarily known as this diverse hub, that seemed to be a very interesting thing and something that kind of brought them together to a degree, especially the kind of relationship between pitcher Bob Gibson and catcher Tim McCarver.
Yeah, very much so. This was a team that, in a lot of ways, you know, you talk to especially opposing, you know, teams that took on the Cardinals, and they felt the Cardinals, in a sense, are the consummate professionals of that era. And, you know, they dressed well. They certainly took a great deal of pride in having, as you say, black whites and Latinos like Glenn Javier, Orlando Cepeda, etc. on their team. I think Gibson probably summed it up the best. He said, in essence, we were the Rainbow Coalition long before Jesse Jackson ever thought up the term.
Right.
And it was, you know, probably kind of interesting for St. Louis fans to look out and see, you know, white, blacks, browns playing, you know, for their team. Also, this was a team that took pride in some having some very almost brutally honest conversations about not just baseball, but about the world in general. And, Brad, you were talking about, you know, Dr. King's assassination. And the day after that occurred was the Cardinals are finishing up spring training. Tim McCarver felt he really needed to discuss this with Bob Gibson, who is, like, obviously one of the most prominent African-American athletes in the country at that point in time. And at first, when McCarver, you know, came to Gibson, Gibson said, I don't even want to talk to you today. You cannot understand what it's like to be a black man in America today, the day after, you know, King has been assassinated. But to McCarver's credit, he kept after Gibson. And probably the last guy that, you know, Gibson really wanted to talk with on that morning would have been a white guy who, ironically, was the son of a policeman in Memphis, of all places, where King had been assassinated. But McCarver was relentless. He kept at it. And they ended up having a very frank conversation that helped, in a sense, McCarver understand where Gibson was coming from. And I think, in a way, it allowed Gibson to kind of understand a little bit, you know, maybe what white America was thinking. It was a team, I think, because of such conversations, was very, very tight. The team chemistry on the St. Louis Cardinals was extraordinary, and I think it had a large degree to do with they really understood each other, despite the very, very backgrounds they came from.
Right, and, you know, throughout the book, there's kind of that constant theme, Bob Gibson is this black pitcher who's just almost playing angry, you know. Obviously, black people had not been treated very well his entire upbringing. Martin Luther King's assassination shocked him. He was infuriated by RFK, and he went out and not only won the Cy Young Award, he comes out, he basically sets the modern-day ERA record, 1.12. And it was just very impressive that this guy, who almost could come off as a curmudgeon, just took that energy and just performed one of the most admirable seasons, really, for a pitcher we've ever seen.
Yeah, very much. And I think if I learned any lesson in writing Summer of 68, Brad, was that all these guys had very human reactions to what was going on around them. It was very easily understood. And Gibson, somehow, he didn't get off to the best of starts in the 68 season. I mean, he was overshadowed by Don Drysdale's scoreless inning streak. I mean, it wasn't like he was thinking the place up, but he wasn't considered, you know, front and center among the star pitching performances as the season began. But one of the things I find amazing about Gibson's season, and you alluded to the 1.12 ERA, well, pretty much that string begins after Kennedy's assassination. And Gibson's first start after Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles, Gibson throws his first shutout of the season. He goes on to throw 13 shutouts, 28 complete games, and that earned run average of 1.12. And Gibson is quoted as saying, in a sense, you know, after they shot Dr. King, I was sad, whatever. But when they killed Bobby Kennedy, I became infuriated. And somehow he was able to channel that anger, passion, even disgust with what was going on around him in the country in general, as you say, into one of the most amazing, I think, pitching seasons we'll ever see.
And what was so interesting was that the exact opposite of that kind of personality was seen in Detroit. You got Denny McClain goes on to get 31 wins, the first 30-game winner since Dizzy Dean. And he has almost the exact opposite attitude. He's a fun-loving guy. He's cracking jokes in the clubhouse, staying up late, showing up, you know, 5 to 10 minutes sometimes before the game starts. And, you know, he also had an amazing season. It was just a really, truly great year for pitchers in baseball that year.
Yeah, it was very much the year of the pitcher, and you're right. McClain, in a sense, responded a different way. You know, he certainly knew what was going on around him. As Gates Brown, the great pinch hitter for Detroit, told me once, he said, you know, nobody was safe. I mean, in a sense, something was going to break your heart with what was going on in the country. It was going to break your heart in that year. McClain's response was to try to have fun, and in a way with it, you know, kind of rise above it all. I think he's like joins that cast of characters of great celebrity athletes with Babe Ruth and maybe Dizzy Dean and guys like that, who no matter what's going on around them, well, they're going to have some fun. And one of the things I loved, you know, somebody did an interview with him about halfway through the 68 season, and they said, Denny, what's your real goal this year? Is it to win the pennant? The Tigers, you know, finished one game out of first place behind Boston the year before. Is it to win 30 games? You're the first guy in decades to win 30 games at the major league level. And Denny just kind of said, well, those are all kind of good, but I'd really like to be on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Exactly.
You know, and
yeah.
He was an accomplished musician, ends up getting on the show and ends up playing an extended, you know, engagement in Las Vegas when the World Series is over. And so here we have two guys, in Gibson and McClain, totally different responses to what's going on around them with the assassinations and the riots, etc. But one of the things I love about that 68 season is both Gibson and McClain, they both pitched 28 complete games. And I'm still stunned by that number, maybe as much as even the earned run average and the 31 victories, 28 complete games. And yet they both kind of found their own way to the top of the mountain, so to speak. And, boy, I mean, we make a big deal now when somebody has 10 or 11 complete games for a season, but both of these guys doing it totally different ways, you know, did far, far better than that.
Right, yeah, I was very impressed, you know, that these guys would go, yeah, the entire distance. And because wins can get a little distracting, because, I mean, Bob Gibson, his ERA is 1.12. I think it was like 21-9, maybe 22-9, and 9 of those losses, you know, he gave up 3 runs or less. So it does seem like that could be somewhat of a, you know, a miscue. But, yeah, I do think to a degree in that era, 1968, if they're going 28 complete games, there is a little more to a win then than there is here, you know, when guy gets a grand slam and then all of a sudden, you know, they win. So I did think that was interesting, too, about the complete games.
Yeah, well, I think an old scout probably summed it up for me the best, you know, when I was doing another book, High Heat, where he said, in essence, maybe the worst thing that ever happened to starting pitchers is when they made a quality start 6 innings. And, you know, you talk to guys like McClain, Mickey Lolich, you know, even maybe some of the lesser lights like Larry Durker and such from this era, and Nolan Ryan's coming on the scene at this point in time. All of these guys, you know, they wanted to finish what they started. It was almost kind of embarrassing to be taken out of a game back in 68. Now you see, you know, it's changing a little bit, but now you see some young pitchers that are like, okay, I've done 6 innings. I'm ahead. You almost see him like looking to the bullpen going, we got some guys warming up. It's about time I got out of here. But, you know, that didn't happen in 68. I mean, these guys are very upset if they had to be taken out of the game. If they felt it was a public showing that they hadn't done their job.
Because that was game 6 of the 68 World Series. The Tigers have almost 10 runs, I think, by the second inning. And here's Denny McClain on 2 days rest, and he's going the whole 9 frames. And you're kind of like, maybe you should save him for another game when you're not already up 10-0. So that was pretty surprising. Like you said, it's almost like, yeah, their egos almost can't handle this idea that they wouldn't be able to pitch the entire distance. I think Bob Gibson went a whole game and it was like 144 pitches, something you'd only probably see now if the guy had a no-hitter or perfect game going.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, the pitch counts aren't really that big. I mean, I think Louis Tiant had a game in 68. Only Louis Tiant leads the American League and earned Ryan A with 1.60. He had one game with like 146 or 147 pitches. You know, in essence, as Nolan Ryan told me one time, he said the mindset at that point in time was, that's your job. You know, you're out there to start and finish the game. And, you know, the only way really you're coming out is maybe when you're not doing your job. And so, you know, pitch counts and, you know, what we have, all these matchups out of the bullpens were really things that were down the line, maybe for good or bad.
And because I guess it was also interesting because how great the pitching was, the offense was so anemic. I remember Carl Yastrzemski, I think, won the AL batting title with like a .300 batting average. And there was there was a really funny anecdote where Sandy Koufax pitches a no-hitter and then Don Drysdale's teammate says, yeah, but did he get the win?
That's right. Did he win? So, and that's how hitting had kind of gone downhill for a degree. And you're absolutely right, Brad. I mean, Yaz wins with the only guy in the American League to hit .300 in the summer of 68. Yet, they still had some pretty amazing hitting performances. You have, in a sense, Frank Howard, hitting like 10 home runs in about a week early on in the season for Washington. You have a guy like Gates Brown who's just money in the bank for when it comes to hits coming off the bench as a pinch hitter. But, you know, you talk to hitters from that era, and they knew what was going on. They just, you know, as Brown told me at one point, he said, look at all the great pitchers, you know? I mean, you had guys that were in their prime, like Drysdale and Gibson and Ferguson Jenkins, et cetera. And then you had kind of this new wave of guys coming up with, you know, guys like a young Larry Durker and certainly Catfish Hunter, who pitches a perfect game, and et cetera, et cetera. And they just said, you just went with it. And I think one of the biggest mistakes baseball, I think, made was they overreacted. They got really kind of antsy that not a lot of runs are being scored instead of maybe embracing this golden era of pitching, which it really was. And I think they changed so many things after the 68 season. I mean, they lowered the mound. They shrunk the strike zone. They, you know, designated hitters, conversations start really picking up. And I was talking to Jim Bouton a while ago, who was pitching in 68, the guy who wrote Ball 4, and he was like going, they didn't have to do any of this. I mean, pitching would have gone downhill a little bit because they were going to expand. You know, and in 69 you had expansion, and that would have diluted the pitching probably enough for the hitters at least to start getting a better shot at it.
One of the other offensive achievements, I guess you could say, throughout that was Mickey Mantle winding that end of his Hall of Fame career, and I want you to tell the anecdote. Danny McClain, a lifelong fanatic of Mickey Mantle, the season's over, you know, the Tigers are going to the World Series, and his childhood hero comes up to the plate, needs a home run to pass Jimmy Fox, and
well, this is McClain maybe at his best, and this is McClain who is intelligent, mischievous, and also a sense of history. Mickey Mantle didn't realize that growing up, in essence, Danny McClain's favorite player was Mickey Mantle. And so as, I believe it's September 21st, and McClain's on the mound, he's well on his way to winning, I believe it's going to be his 31st victory on that day, which is, you know, so he's well past 30. Up comes Mickey Mantle. And McClain is maybe one of the few in the ballpark outside of the Yankees dugout who realizes that the Mick is right at that point tied with Jimmy Fox for third all-time on the home run list. And Mickey Mantle has not been having the best of seasons. So McClain decides, in essence, he's going to groove a fastball to Mantle to make sure he moves past Fox on the all-time list. And it ends up being this whole kind of almost Keystone Cops, you know, setup where Jim Price is catching that day for Bill Freehan, the backup catcher. He's in as a backup catcher for Freehan for Detroit. Kind of gets the message mixed, and Mantle ends up taking two pitches right down the pipe at maybe 65 miles an hour that he could have pummeled. And finally, McClain, leaving nothing to chance, kind of yells in from the mound asking Mantle, where do you want the ball? And Mantle at this point kind of realizes, oh, okay, good. He's just going to lob it over the plate and see if I could hit it. And Mantle kind of signifies by kind of, you know, waving his hand about chest high, inside part of the plate. McClain kind of nods his head, okay, that's where you're going to get it, and that's where he puts it. And Mantle hits it out of the ballpark. Okay, passes Fox. As he's going around the bases, he tips his hat to McClain and yells out, thank you. And the guy who's in the on-deck circle for the Yankees and watching this whole thing is Joe Pepitone. And Joe Pepitone steps in finally after everything's done and everybody kind of realizes what a big deal it is. And he signals out to McClain the same thing that Mantle had done, you know, kind of with his hand, oh, inside part of the plate, you know, about letter high. And, of course, McClain throws the next one at his head.
Exactly. Don't take too much advantage of Danny McClain or else you could feel that high heat. But I love that. I thought that was the only kind of thing that happened in the Bull Durham movie, not real life with history on the line. I guess that was his Favre sack for Michael Strahan moment.
Right. Now, I think Danny McClain was living his own version of the Bull Durham movie for most of his life.
So what was also an interesting opposition kind of thing was 1967, you know, the civil rights riots kind of break out, and Detroit pretty much is in, you know, disheveled. And by 1968, everybody's kind of on the edge of their seat expecting something else to potentially happen when all these big things are going on. And yet it seemed like the city of Detroit was almost united behind the Tigers, and this whole thing got kind of, whether it was delayed or melted away. It does seem like the Detroit Tigers actually did have a positive impact on the community that year.
Oh, very much so. And I think they knew, unlike maybe, you know, the only thing I can really equate to it is maybe Yankees after 9/11 or something like that, where a team knows the stakes and, you know, that they can unite a community. As you allude to, Brad, I mean, what people tend to forget is the worst riot since the Civil War occurred in Detroit, the city of Detroit, in 67. Big chunks of the city burned, and, you know, and in essence, Detroit is still reeling from that to a large degree. And the ball players were actually told, the Tiger players were told before the season got going by city officials and police officials, hey, it would be great if you guys, you know, finally won. You know, maybe that would help us out and kind of help keep the city together. So I can't think of another team that has started the season under that much pressure. Hey, why don't you win and save the city from burning up again? And ironically, they did. They rose to the occasion. They time and time again were able to rally from being, you know, well behind in the late innings. I believe they rallied 23 or 24 times trailing going into the eighth inning or later. And police and city officials soon noticed that, you know, whereas in 67, if you had a group of people, especially young males, on the street corner in Detroit, that was probably trouble. But there, you know, you had a gathering like that. Now, in 68, probably they were all kind of gathered around a transistor radio listening to Ernie Harwell, the great voice of the Tigers, call the action. And in a sense, yeah, it rallied the city. It really took the edge off and allowed Detroit in some shape to move ahead and, you know, try to gather themselves. And I think sometimes we forget how much sports can really bring a community together, but we were certainly reminded of that again in the summer of 68.
Absolutely. And, you know, 1968 is such a great baseball season. It's still the king of the mountain in terms of sports. I think 75 million people watched the rain-soaked game that Bob Gibson pitched through. Yet you can kind of see that there is the beginning of that changing of the guard from baseball to the NFL. You know, America's slowly becoming a bigger football country. Not as many people showed up for the first Super Bowl, but by, you know, the time of 1968, we got the Heidi game, which you were fortunate enough to watch, and that sort of seemed to be a symbol that America really cared about football, and it was there to stay.
Yeah, very much, and I even the powers that be in football weren't sure of how much, in essence, the U.S. public was kind of coming over to their sport until something like the Heidi game, where they, you know, cut the game off at 7 o'clock for a made-for-TV movie called Heidi, and the switchboards at NBC and at the New York Times almost melted down. So many people were calling in going, what happened to the game? And this is well before we had such systematic type of television ratings that we have now, and that suddenly occurred to a lot of the powers of being football. They were more popular than we think we are, and they certainly were. And, you know, it's funny. I think baseball, in a lot of ways, may have left the door open for other sports to come in part because they thought they were going to be on top forever. But, you know, it was certainly, yeah, very much a changing of the guard, because not only football, but also in 68, this is where the Olympics start to come on. This is where a guy named Rune Arledge decides, oh, I think we'll have some of, we'll do live programming from Mexico City, and people, you know, were enthralled and even angered by, you know, some of the things that went on there, and suddenly the Olympics became prime time viewing also.
So here we are, you know, the World Baseball Classic is here for the third time. You know, you've written a lot extensively on baseball, especially its impact in Latin America, places like Cuba. Overall, you find yourself pretty interested in this tournament. Where do you stand on it?
I tend to like the World Baseball Classic. I think, ironically, we're kind of being hit again, or even, I guess what I'm trying to say, Brad, is reminded how popular baseball is outside of our borders. We tend to forget it a little bit. I mean, sometimes things boil over, like what happened with Mexico and Canada the other night, but the World Baseball Classic is getting a lot of attention and publicity in outside our borders. And I think sometimes I'm a little perplexed by how we don't really, I don't know, sell the game to a certain extent. here we have, in essence, kind of the same platform or the same kind of showcase for the sport that, say, basketball, the NBA had with the Dream Team. And yet we've got a team, the U.S. team, that, yeah, it's got some stars, but, okay, where's Justin Verlander? Where's, all the top guys that would really kind of turn heads? And I think sometimes we forget that, in a sense, supremacy in this game is huge around the world. And I think sometimes we forget how popular baseball is outside. A quick story. This is a couple of years ago, but there's a guy named a scout for Seattle who actually, back when he was in the Mets, also signed Daryl Strawberry. He's got signed A-Rod. He signed Ken Griffey. And I check in with him every now and then. A couple of years ago, I was talking with him, and I said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "Well, of course, I've been down in the Dominican Republic at our academy. Everybody's got an academy now, taking a look at some pretty promising players." But then he said, "After that, I went on to China, Italy, Holland, I'm forgetting, Croatia," and essentially went around the world. And I went, "Why'd you do that?" And he goes, "Because they all had great players, and even though China's still got a little ways to come, and almost all those countries, I signed prospects. And they love our game. They love our national pastime around the world." And sometimes I think we need to acknowledge that a little bit more, too, and realize that we could play that up within our own borders, so to speak.
Absolutely. And Italy did look pretty impressive in the first pool play. And this wasn't that cutesy, like, Mike Piazza, Barry Zito, they're going to play Italy. So, yeah, it is interesting and fun to kind of watch these other countries come about. And even the Netherlands upsetting Cuba was a pretty big shocker.
Still stunned by that. I'm just like going, Netherlands upset Cuba. That's crazy. But, it used to be that, you could just kind of pencil in who was going to get into this second round just by looking at the teams. And now you can't. We're getting some major upsets. I mean, Netherlands and Italy have played, relatively well at times. The other thing I'm finding striking, and the U.S. was almost in this boat until they won their game against Canada, where the U.S., of all teams, the U.S. was maybe going to have to go through a qualifying thing because so many other teams wanted to see if they could get in the World Baseball Classic. It's other countries. And so there's a lot of attention. And at some points, maybe it's playing it at a different time of the year. Maybe it's figuring out what's going on with the pitching, talk about pitch counts and such like that. Or maybe it's just trying to get more of the U.S. players really excited to play it. But, I think it's a great venue that I wish we were appreciating a little bit more.
Absolutely. The book is Summer 68, The Season That Changed Baseball and America Forever. Tim, thank you very much for being on the show, and best of luck to you going forward.
Very good. Thank you, Brad. My pleasure.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Thanks.